telephone the headquarters of the Israeli army, said, for heaven's sake, we have no arms, we have no ammunition. How can we fight? And the answer of headquarters was, all around Safed are armed Arabs. We can't send anybody there. Alef Beit, which means aim Barrera. You have no choice. You must do what you can. They told the Mapamniks told me the Arabs were monitoring that conversation, and they said, all in peace, atomic bomb! And the 3,000 Arabs fled, and the 385 Kibbutzis were victorious. That was the first miracle in war. The second has to do with peace and with an American professor of agriculture who in 1947 came to Israel to offer advice. And he saw the wilderness, and he saw naked rocks, and he saw the miserable huts of the Arabs who had gone. And he said, my friends, you will have an awful trouble here. It takes hundreds of years for you to build up the country. He came back 7 years later, and to his astonishment, the desert had been pushed away. The naked rocks are covered with sort of plants. He said, for heaven's sake, what do you use as fertilizer? That is miraculous what you have. And the Kalutzim answered, we use as fertilizer sechel. It wasn't true. They had not only sechel, but they had back-breaking work. Every one of them felt the obligation to build up the homeland. And now I come to the third miracle. That for the third miracle you need more patience. It is a paragraph in the Talmud. You find it in the Shulchan Aruch. It says in Hebrew, before I come to that, there is a Mishnah which says, have a so here, I translate it to English in a moment. Have it so here, the mitzvah kala kevachamuro, ke eina to yadea matan schora she mitzvah. Be very careful with regard to something that seems to you a minor mitzvah, treat it with the same earnestness as if it were a bigger one, because you do not know what the reward is of performing a mitzvah. What is it? The Gemara says in Megillah, Omar Ruben, Sefer Torah Shebala Gomzin also is a Talmud Chochom. If a Sefer Torah becomes worn out, you put it next to the grave of a scholar. You don't allow it to be lying in a corner. You want to be careful that the shamos, anything having the name of God, is not treated carelessly. So you must put it next to the grave of a Talmud Chochom or into the coffin of a Talmud Chochom. And another rabbi said, well, put it bekleheres, put it into earthenware vessels, and put it somewhere where they will be kept. Who cares about that? Who knows about that? It's a little known paragraph, a very small mitzvah apparently. And it became a buried treasure of profound significance. Why? I don't like to give you too much of unpleasant thing, but the church preached so much hatred of the Jew and of Jewish literature, that, for instance, in the case of Rabbi Achiel of Paris, they had 46 big tracts of Jewish manuscript which they burned, destroyed. You know, up to the end of the 15th century, we did not know printing. The only people who knew printing much earlier, believe it or not, were the Chinese. They had printing much earlier. And so to own a book meant to have employed a copy, a writer, or a copyist. And not all the copies were reliable, and not all the copies were learned. And some of the most curious mistakes or errors happened in the copying. There is one story, a short one, which Rashi quotes. It says, Lamsi Bisi Eschemite Filinum Vesuzos, Veteran Shinich Nasim Laharet. The Lord says, I didn't tell you anything about Filinum Vesuzos before you entered the Holy Land. That simply isn't true. Because you know what Shema is? Ukshatem Le'ausa Yodecha Vohoilet Atokos Benedecha. The Shema which Moshe Rabbeinu conveyed to the people said you should bind them as a sign on your hand, as something between your eyes. How could Rashi say, quote, the Midrash is saying, I didn't tell you about filling the mezuzah. In order to understand that, you must know how careless a copyist was. The original text read, Lautzi Visi Eschem al Trumaus Umasraus, Meterem Shinechlasten Ore. I didn't tell you you have to give Truma to the Kohanim or Masi of your money before you entered the land. A careless copyist didn't write Trumaus Umasraus, but wrote Top Wolf Mem. And another careless copyist interprets Top Wolf Mem as Tfilin Umasraus. That sort of thing happens with manuscripts. I could give you more, but I have not more. Now, where does the miracle come in? In 1882, about 1100 years ago, in the city, in the suburb of Fostal, near Cairo, my wife and I were there. We saw that synagogue. There was a Coptic church which the Jews bought and made into a synagogue, the Ezra Synagogue. They were very religious Jews, and when they had any Hebrew text that was capable of becoming old and worn out, they put it into a dark room. And they called it the Geniza room. Gonas means to hide, to put away. This Geniza room, where there were manuscripts, letters, scrolls, ksubos, kiddushin, all sorts of things, this manuscript was not known outside the membership of the people in Fostal, in the small shul. Meantime, as I told you, there was a terrible destruction of Jewish texts all over the world, all over Europe. Then a miracle happened. In 1850, a man called Kirkovich, who was not a nice fellow, but a scholar, he came to Cairo. He was a Karaite, you know, the reformers of 1,000 years ago. And he heard that there are manuscripts there. So he managed to that a Russian non-Jew called Augustine went there again and he bought them. Suddenly it became known that the Geniza room was a kind of a treasure house. You could sell the manuscripts, and some people stole them. Dr. Silas Adler of Philadelphia went there and brought home quite a collection. Elkan Adler of London, the son of the chief rabbi, brought there. And curiously enough, part of the miracle, the Geniza was promoted by non-Jews. One were two ladies. One was called Mrs. Lewis, the other was Mrs. Gibson. They were both non-Jewish ladies, interested in Hebrew literature. They came to Cambridge, England, from Postal, and showed to their reader in the rabbinics of Cambridge, Dr. Solomon Schechter, later on the president of the Jewish Theological Seminary, what they had found. They said, we bought it from some people in Postal. He looked at it. It was incredible. It was a translation of Aquilas, of Onkelos, of the Bible into Greek. And another thing of Ben Sira. He said that it's incredible, there must be more of it. And Dr. Taylor, a professor at Cambridge, a non-Jew, said, look here, we are going to get everything from there. I give you the money. Dr. Schechter said, well, that's fine, but we need more. He made arrangements with the Warburg family, the Schiff family, Oxford University, Cambridge University, the British Museum, and they let him go there. He stayed in the Geniza for 6 weeks. It was a dark room, no windows. The air wasn't very good, but it was very dry, so that the manuscripts were kept. And he brought home 67 boxes of this size. When I was a student at Cambridge, I saw some of them. The original view was that Dr. Schechter himself brought 100,000 manuscripts, some as small as that, some big scrolls. He brought them, he gave them part to Budapest, to the Jewish Theological Seminary there, part to the British Museum. As I told you before, part was in Leningrad, which the Kirkovich and the decent Christian had brought there. And suddenly, the scholars of the Jewish world discovered something that they had never dreamt of. They discovered the correct text of the Talmud, of the Babylonian Talmud and the Talmud of Jerusalem. I remember a queer thing with one scholar, I won't mention his name, somewhere in America, who was quite a scholar and very ingenious. The Talmud of Jerusalem had some difficult texts. The meaning was not clear. And he wrote a big commentary, I have it in my library, in which with great deal of ingenuity he explained the difficulties. There was not a word of truth about them. They were wrong copies. They were the mistakes and the carelessness of copies. And Professor Louis Ginsberg published 2 volumes on the Talmud of Jerusalem on the basis of the Geniza text. A man called Dr. Menashe Binyamin Levine wrote 15 volumes of a new text of the Babylonian Talmud. If I do not exaggerate, there are 100 volumes and 500 learned articles, all based on the Geniza. I show you one thing to bring the whole picture for you. He told me the following story. You remember? The Geniza material was either put into a room or into the coffin or near the coffin of a scholar. Rabbi Wertheimer was a marvelous person, very fine appearance, and very, very poor. He had a very clean and exceedingly shabby apartment. He told me one day I was sitting in my room and an Arab came. And he said, "Look what I found. You can have it." He looked at it. He said, "I didn't trust my eyes. It was the commentary of Satya Govana Neo, 1,000-year-old. I had to think fast. I knew where the Arab got it from. He had pillaged the grave and the coffin. So I thought if I give him what it was worth, not a single coffin in Jerusalem will be saved." So he said to him what was true, "Look, I'm a very poor man. It's an interesting thing. I can only give you a quarter." And the Arab said, "All right, give me a quarter. Maybe I'll come again." And that was how the miracle happened. He published thereupon the commentary of Sadia Gaon of the 10th century. I had a different experience in the Vatican. I confess I was there. I was introduced to the librarian and I had a mixed kind of a feeling. You must believe me. I saw manuscripts, Hebrew manuscripts, bound in gold with jewelry on the four corners. I saw incunabula, you know, books printed before the year 1500. First of all, I had kinna sinno. I had a feeling of envy and anger because how did they get into the Vatican? They robbed and raped them from rich Jews. And then I said to myself, "No, I'm utterly wrong. Because through the Vatican, these manuscripts were saved. And one of my beloved teachers, Professor Abraham Molina, went to the Vatican and produced the first correct text of Rashi on the Torah from the manuscript of the Vatican." We have to be grateful to the Vatican, even if they took them by force and removed them from their owners. Because they kept them, we had that. You know, the oldest Aramaic manuscript is Unkelos, the translator of the Torah into Aramaic. Our people spoke Aramaic from Babylon. Professor Molina in the Vatican found the oldest manuscript of Unkelos. And just 5 years ago, the miracle isn't over yet, there was Dr. Feely, whom I met in 1956 or 7. He's a Christian scholar who knows Hebrew very well and Aramaic pretty well. He had a couple of hours in the library. So he went looking for manuscripts. He thought maybe I'll find something new. And he saw a big manuscript. On top of it was written Targum Onkelos, the Targum which Molina had already published. So he said, "Well, I won't bother about it. That has been attended to." But as he describes it, he had nothing to do for an hour. So he opened that manuscript and he saw it wasn't Targum Onkelos at all. It was something altogether different. There is a very great scholar in Jerusalem called Rabbi Menachem Kasher. He got in touch with that Professor Feely. He got to look at the manuscript, and you know what it was? We have three Talmudim: Onkelos, Jonathan, and Yerushalmi. Onkelos and Jonathan are pretty complete. Yerushalmi was in fragments. Rabbi Kasher discovered that this tremendous manuscript was a Targum Yerushalmi, and he says it comes from the time of Ezra. That means it's about 2,500 years old. And he published a year ago a volume called Targumim, based on something like Geniza. We learned something that we never knew. Professor Jacob Mann, a colleague of mine, we worked together at the British Museum, produced a two-volume history of Egyptian Jews for 250 years, about whom we knew nothing. Nothing whatsoever. And what these manuscripts tell us is so much fascinating detail. For instance, we learn what the Jews did from the 8th to the 13th century. You will be astonished to hear that they engaged in something in which New York Jewry engages. Textiles, metals, and also the production of purple. They traveled from ancient Babylonia up to Spain. They sold those things all over the Mediterranean. And something else you learn, they had non-Jewish partners, Mohammedan partners, who lived in peace with them. Today you wouldn't believe it. The Arab partners from the 8th to the 13th century worked together with the Jews. You know, Jewish physicians were very welcome at the courts because they were exemplary in knowledge and in character. There were some other things we learned. They traveled. In Hebrew, there is one word to describe travels. It's called sakanat darachim, the danger of the roads. What does that mean? For hundreds of years, there were princes and dukes and others who lived on attacking caravans, killing the people or at best robbing them. So that if a man traveled, he had to be exceedingly careful. We know from the text what happened. Before he traveled, they had a service in the synagogue. In Syria, in Jordania, in Morocco. The Rav had to come there and to join in prayers to Hashem Yisborach to protect the traveler. Then there came people who accompanied the traveler so that he won't be alone. The travels extended from 4 to 8 years, if you please. And they had to make a double provision. Provision for the family at home and introduction to people who might help them in one of the various countries. It was a matter of great prestige to be a traveler. And when they came back, they had a feast, they had a public thanksgiving, and the family didn't know what to do with joy. Before they left, they had a tarnish, a fast, to impress upon the Lord the seriousness of the situation. We had not the faintest notion of all that. We owe it to the miracle of the Geniza, of the papers, scrolls, fragments. How did we know that? They had some manuscripts in Leningrad, and Professor Katz of Drexel University in Philadelphia got permission in the last few years from the Soviet government. He brought back 450 microfilms meantime, we get the miracle of the information. As a Professor Goitein in Jerusalem was published two books on the Middle East. What he describes is incredible, as if it were found strangers somewhere up the moon. We had no notion of how the Jews lived, of how they made a living. And something very funny. Well, I can't help giving you something I'm not very keen on giving you. I had a bad case the other day, during the last 2 years. I had lectured at Columbia on love. And then a young woman called me up and she said, I must see you. I looked at my calendar, I had little time, and I promised my wife as an exception to be home in good time for dinner. But she said, I must see you. And she cried on the phone and said, all right, come over. She came over. Fine-looking girl, I mean, intellectual integrity. You would trust her after 5 minutes. And she said to me, I am the only child of my mother. I have no father anymore. She tried to spoil me all my life. She gave me what I didn't want. She bestowed upon me everything she could and other things she couldn't. Well, I found a glorious young boy. I married him. He's the finest husband on earth. He's very respectful and very loving and very attentive. My mother called him up and said, how dare you treat my daughter so badly? He said, for heaven's sake, I'm treating her with all the love and regard I have. And she calls me up and she said, how could you stay with that fellow? He doesn't know how to respect you. And she said, she's going to ruin our marriage. Well, I couldn't do anything else. I said, all right, I'll see her. She came to see me. She lives not 2 miles from here. I have to be careful now. And she was charming, charitable, fine-looking. I said to her, what are you doing? You are destroying the happiness of the young people. She said, oh, I said, yes, you and your daughter spoke to me. I've seen your son-in-law too. She said, I don't know. I decided to be very harsh with her. I said, you know, there are 3 terrible words in modern English. What are they? The one is communist. The other is fascist. The third is in-laws. Then she began to realize what I was driving at. And 10 days later, the young woman called me up and said, I can't tell you, Rabbi, what to owe to you. For the last 10 days, she blessed us alone. We are living in peace. Why do I tell you all that? Because in the Geniza manuscripts, there is a reference to a mother-in-law and a father-in-law who rendered the life of the people very miserable. And so the Besdin had to decide that the wife whose husband was traveling somewhere in the Mediterranean must be given the top floor and the mother-in-law was forbidden to enter it. There is a certain sameness in human affairs, which is as fascinating as it's sometimes breathtaking and sometimes very saddening. Among the things we discovered was a sect about which we never knew. We have their Sidur and their Minhagim. Among the things we discovered was an amazing story of a man called Johannes, who was a Norman, a Goy. 11th century, he became a Jew by conviction and was called Obadiah. We never heard of him. The Geniza gave it to us. You know that a few few years ago, there was a man here in America. I met him. He came from Tokyo. He was a university professor. He didn't like Japanese heathenism, so he became a convert to Christianity. He didn't like Christianity, so he decided to become a Jew. He went to Jerusalem and Mila performed on himself. His name was Pasucci, and he lectured in some of the country, in some of the cities of the United States. I would say that we have another tremendous wealth to study. 43,000 manuscripts of the 200,000, 100,000 Dr. Schesterbrod, another 100,000 Pirkovich and the non-Jewish men and others brought. And we do not know how much knowledge we shall acquire in the next 100 years. That was a buried treasure I wanted to talk to you about. That was a miracle of miracles due to the fact that Jews observed a little paragraph of Jewish law which said you must not allow a Sefer Torah or any manuscript be shamed with God's name to be put aside. You have to be sure that they are being protected. Out of that came the new miracle. I'd like you to be proud and happy with me to think of what, in what wonderful manner, religious Jews, Jews who had a sense of the value of these things, were rewarded. Perhaps in the next 5 years you will get the books of, or you'll hear about the books if you won't get them, of Professor Shraga Abramson of the Hebrew University. He has just now published a volume, two volumes of one work about the life of the Geonim, that means the heads of the yeshivot of Babylonia from the 6th to the 10th century. In these two volumes, which are not easy reading, they are in Hebrew, but in these two volumes, he opens to you a vision of utterly new information. We knew what they had in Babylonia. The people were decent. They allowed them to live their own life. The Jews had cultural autonomy. They could decide what was right and wrong. They had Besdin, they had scholars. We knew that, but we didn't know the details. We had a frame, but we didn't know the content. We didn't have the picture. Through Geniza, we shall learn all that. So when you hear the word Geniza in the future, translated, something put aside, something hidden, something left for the scholars of the future. At the same time, one of the greatest miracles of Jewish history. I hope I haven't bored you to extinction.
Abe Beyer was the chairman.
K-A-H-L-E. The book is called The Geniza of Cairo. as you will find that something that was never known has become public property in the learned world and can become the private property, especially of any Jew or Jewish.